Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Here we are in the kitchen again. This is KHOI. This is Community Radio. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintos.
We are getting together on this beautiful September day to bring you another fine hour of food, local food, local environment, recipes, advice, opinions. We do it all here, folks. And this is the whole show and this whole radio station is put together by volunteers. We are your community radio station. We get support from a lot of nice people.
Support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames. Community-owned, community-focused, since 1974, open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
Well, today we're going to be talking about the end of this garden season here. It's time to clean up the garden. It's time to plan for next year, but do keep on harvesting. There's a lot of stuff out there. And we'll take.
And it could go a while. We don't know
when
the frost date will be.
Right. And we're also going to visit a local prairie. So stick around. We'll have a very good time. Yes, there's lots of things to keep on harvesting out there, although I'm turning over old beds that look very sad this time of year. And it's a nice, surprising time of year. Things get harvested that you didn't even know were there. I had a nice young man show up at my door last night, give me this strange little green object and say, "Here, have you ever tasted one of these? Donna, have you ever tasted a pawpaw?"
I only tasted one time. I found it absolutely delicious, except I can't remember quite what it tasted like. Very fruity and as you would say, wasn't the texture sort of persimmonish or something?
Well, yeah, it's like mush. It's like to have a really good ripe pawpaw, you have to have it very, very ripe because it's like custard on the inside. Eat it in one great big slurp or eat it with a spoon.
They're not like persimmons where there's an astringency to
no.
them if they're not ripe, though.
No. It's a very mild banana-ish, sort of mango-ish. It's not very tart at all. It's just smooth. It's like sort of like a pudding.
Well, I remember at the time I ate my one and only and had a pawpaw experience, thinking, why can't we have more of these?
Well, I don't.
Other than having someone appear at your front door with a local foraged item, how on earth do we find them?
Well, now, he would not tell me where this pawpaw tree is, but he did indicate it is somewhere on the ISU campus. But that's fine.
Does that mean, Lana, you could plant some pawpaw trees?
I have looked into pawpaws. I have not planted them. I understand that we are at the north end of where pawpaws grow. They generally grow south of here. Oh, matter of fact, I should ask my friend Rick Exner. I think he's had a luck with pawpaws. I know it's one of those things that winter can sort of be hard on it here, so it's an iffy sort of proposition. But evidently this year we have pawpaws. Little green thing. It sort of looks like you're a very unlumpy, very light-colored cucumber. And you think, right.
Are they elongated?
Yes, they're an elongated sort of thing. He actually gave me another one that said would possibly ripen on the counter. One was mushy, and I ate that right away. And besides being mushy on the inside and kind of pinkish, yellowish, creamyish colored.
Do they have seeds in them?
It has seeds. And that's why I said it sort of reminded me of a persimmon, because it has a rather flat, big, little smaller than a dime size.
I wonder if they're related to cherimoyas, which are tropical. And do you have to pick them, let them ripen? They get very custardy, and they do have those large flat seeds. I don't know.
Well, if anybody out there knows about pawpaws, that's something you can help us be enlightened
Isn't
about.
Isn't there an old rhyme or a song about picking pawpaws or something?
It's something about the pawpaw patch.
So it's a southern fruit,
yeah, I don't
basically.
Know, mulberry bushes and pawpaw patches. Actually, finding out bits of wisdom through old nursery rhymes and songs, they're usually pretty right spot on. So that's my pawpaw experience, and I wonder if anyone else out there has a pawpaw story.
Well, that reminds me, we have yet to have the persimmon and chestnut harvest.
Oh,
we have that to look forward to.
Oh, that is farther on, because those things hang on the tree and hang up.
Yeah.
Oh, so we'll talk about that in the future, Donna-Lon. So, what have you been doing in your kitchen?
The basil. I think it was a bit of a difficult year for basil. The leaves look kind of beat up a lot. Probably too much rain. What do you think? Is that the problem with it? But what basil one does have, I usually always make sure that I pick the last of it, you know, when I know the frost is coming the next day. I scurry out and tie it into bunches and hang it and dry it. But there are other, like today I've ordered some lemon basil from Farm to Folk, and I'm going to try. And the other one I usually try and dry is Thai basil, because you cannot buy those flavored basils anywhere. So it's really nice to have them in the kitchen in the middle of the winter, especially Thai or lemon, because they're a little exceptional. But even our regular old basil, besides drying, which Lana and I both favor a lot, and we've talked about this, now is a good time of year to dry them. And then I just let them – I tie them in fairly small bunches, and I actually hang them from the curtain rod in a not very sunny window. And then when I notice they start to fall onto the floor, I realize, oh, these are dry. And I take them down, and over a newspaper, you gently strip the dry leaves off the branches, because not crushing them is important. That keeps more of the volatile oils available for when you do want to cook them. And then you put them in a glass jar and store them in a dark place. Other options for basil storage, and there are several, is, of course, to make pesto and freeze it. People like to freeze them in ice cube trays so that you have little amounts to use. Or if you don't want to go the whole way making pesto, which of course includes, you know, putting in pine nuts and Parmesan cheese and garlic and all that sort of thing, just taking a good olive oil and a lot of basil in the food processor and whipping them up and making little cubes is a good way to preserve them.
So it turns it into kind of this nice green paste.
Yeah, and then you can drop them in into soups and stuff. One thing I like to do with using the basil cubes or the pesto starters, and I'll do this with lots of other herbs, like if I'm cooking or simmering a long cooking soup or a chili or anything that cooks for a while, I'll start with some dried of whatever herb I'm using in the long cooking process. And then shortly before you serve it at the end, I put another, like if I have cubes of basil, I would put another one in so you still have this sort of more fresh notes at the end. So you can use it, you know, it changes flavor as you cook it for a long time, which is, it's very nice. It blends into the base of the soup. But to put that little extra blast in at the very finishing is really nice. Another suggestion that I think I might try is infusing vodka with basil.
Oh, that sounds right up your alley.
And that is a no-brainer. Just get some plain vodka or Everclear, put it in a, you know, glass jar and put in a good amount of basil. Let it sit. And there you have it.
That'd be a good flavoring. I never thought of it that way.
I think so. And then, of course, there are two other options that I think would be great to make all three of them if you have plenty of basil, is infusing vinegar. And I would tend to use, I think for basil, I would probably base it in either a white wine vinegar or even an unseasoned brown rice vinegar, something kind of light and not, like, I don't use white distilled vinegar. I think it's too tart. But I think a good white wine vinegar is a good place to do that. And don't forget to make your tarragon vinegar, too, for the winter. And then the third thing is, of course, is infusing some olive oil. You just take a jar, put the olive oil in, put the leaves in, and let her sit.
And this can sit on the counter out of the sunlight, right? With mm-hmm, vinegar, mm-hmm. The
vinegar or the olive oil.
Or the vodka.
Or the vodka. Okay. I tend to stick them in the pantry. And also, I think I've done this with my vodka, I mean my olive oil. Not only do I put the basil in, but I drop a split clove of garlic into it and possibly a few peppercorns. Ooh. There you go.
There you go. Get ready
Make
for
that
winter.
Basil last. There's nothing like the freshness of our own gardens.
And you can use up all those little tops and dribs and drabs. The basil plants may not look pretty, but use up all the flavor.
Yeah,
the
not attractive ones are especially good if you're going to just blitz them in the food processor.
Very good. Very good. I have something I'd like to share with you. We're moving on to apple season. We mentioned apples.
Yes,
and it's a good time of year around here. I ran across this fine book at the Ames Public Library called Apples of Uncommon Character, 123 Heirlooms, Modern Classics, and Little Known Wonders. And the author is Rowan Jacobson. It's a wonderful book. Beautiful pictures. He's got some recipes at the back. This is a guy who likes to talk about apples. And I'm going to share with you a bit about the apple Northern Spy. You can find the Northern Spy apple around here. It's kind of a good baker, a good saucer.
Do you think it's the same as the Prairie Spy, close relative maybe?
I don't know.
Something Spy?
Maybe, yeah. This way. Anyway, it was discovered, or at least it's marked as the start of Northern Spy in East Bloomfield, New York in 1800. That's when it first kind of came.
It's an old apple.
Oh, but nobody really quite knew why it was called Northern Spy. It's really a lovely apple. It's a big, firm, sharply acidic apple. It's a good winter pie apple.
It's kind of red streaked with green. Very pretty.
Very pretty. It said it ferments really well into hard cider.
Oh, good to know.
Yeah, and here's some words here from this book in front of me here from the author Rowan Jacobson. He says, clean and crisp with a steely edge of acidity running through it, which is true. It's a big apple. And he also says it'll keep a kid busy all afternoon. It's a big apple. It's juicy, and it takes a while to eat one.
I don't know what kind of children can be kept busy doing any one thing all afternoon. But.
What apple's lovely. But the name of Northern Spy has caused a century of head scratching. Some have proposed that it was originally called Northern Pie. After all, it does make fine pies.
It's a pie apple.
Others say maybe it was called Northern Spice, and it's rather spicy, sort of. But the best evidence comes from an 1853 letter from Rochester, New York, to a gardening magazine, to wit. In reply to Mrs. B., who inquired about the name of Northern Spy Apple, everybody here knows it was named for the hero of that notorious dime novel, The Northern Spy, but no one will come out to admit it. Understandably so. Remember, this is 1830. The anonymous 1830 novel, The Northern Spy, is about an abolitionist, a swashbuckling sort of character, straight out of Quentin Tarantino, who established an underground railroad. Now, this is a popular novel of the time. He established an underground railroad from Virginia to Canada. Posing as a slave catcher, he killed true slave catchers in ambushes before he died in a battle. But it was claimed by some that the Northern Spy story was a work of propaganda that helped to incite the Civil War. Considering the sensitivity of the topic of slavery in 1853, no wonder no one would fess up to this association. But once you know the connection, there's no denying that the apple fits. With its hulking shoulders, its acerbic temperament, Northern Spy is as formidable an apple as you find. And there's a cold climate abolitionist severity in its mien. There you go.
All right.
This is a nice book.
Yeah, so it says that Rowan Jacobson is a James Beard Award-winning author. Now, when I see a cookbook that has somebody who's been honored by the James Beard Society, it makes me take the a lot more seriously. There are cookbooks and there are cookbooks, you know, just like everybody cooks and everybody writes. It seems that everybody writes cookbooks. And I, you know, the quality and variety is quite astounding. Usually when I have a James Beard Award writer, it means the recipes have first and foremost been thoroughly tested and are quite reliable. And also there is an art to writing a good recipe, because what you're doing is essentially trying to take an oral tradition, which is what cooking is. Oh, here's how you do it. Look at this. But you have to describe it.
Also this task of describing apples, which tend to be, oh yeah, try this apple. It sort of tastes like.
Exactly.
And this author has done a lovely job of researching, but also talking about apples.
Well, it takes a lot to write a recipe so that it's not so detailed and overwhelmingly long that nobody wants to bother, and yet it tells you exactly where to go in few but very clear words. And then also usually recipes nowadays do give encouragement and information about the products you're using and why, out of all the millions and millions of recipes on the planet, you would want to bother to try this one. Now, I like this apple book because it divides it into summer apples, dessert apples, bakers and saucers, keepers, which means they're good storage apples, cider fruit, oddballs, recipes, and then there's a glossary and resources. So the recipes were quite good, and not a lot of them, but just nicely chosen. The bulk of the book really is describing all of these apples and having them in the categories of knowing, okay, which apples do keep? Which ones are you going to have to use? And I get these questions all the time. Which is a cooking apple? Which is an eating apple? And some varieties, of course, are both. And some varieties are distinctly only good for one or the other. So I think this is a lovely book that we have at the Ames Library called Apples of Uncommon Character by Rowan Jacobson. Lana has it checked out now, but it'll be back in there.
Yeah, I will return it soon.
Mm-hmm.
Good. You are listening to KHOI. Support this radio station. And you can contact us here at the Donna Lana Kitchen with anything about apples or pawpaws or basil, anything you'd like to tell us. You can contact our Gmail address, khoiradio@gmail.com, and make a little note to the DLK, Donna Lana Kitchen. We'll listen to a bit of music here. Back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. It's September. We're starting to notice the change of the seasons. Green is turning to gold. This is a good time to celebrate the wild Iowa landscape. Yes, there is still some of it left.
Yeah, and all the herds of mosquitoes that we have.
That is. They're part of the landscape, too.
Oh, boy.
But not all of Iowa is in rectangles and straight lines of corn and soybeans. There are some wild places left. There's a place not too far from the southeast edge of Ames called Stargrass. Roger Maddox And Cindy Hildebrandt called this place home. For the past few decades, they've been gathering, seeding, nurturing, and restoring a native prairie ecosystem. Iowa used to be made up of a lot of prairie, savanna, and wetlands. And Roger and Cindy are doing a good job of taking care of their land. Joe Lynch and I recently visited with Roger Maddox to walk through his Stargrass Prairie and see the new wetlands and ponds that they've developed in the past few years. One thing that's evident when talking to Roger Maddox about his land is that for him, all the hard work is a labor of love.
Uh-huh. We moved out here with the idea of doing prairie recreation. It's a lot of fun, and you recreate a prairie. So our first purchase was the house and the land, which ran from the corner all the way down to this tree with just 10 acres, and we got another 11 acres and then a farm field for 6 acres further to the north. Mm-hmm. Worked on that for 25 years.
Right.
Then we bought the 120 acres around us.
Wow.
Completing 145, a couple hundred feet away. But now it goes all the way down to the trees on the south side of the road, and we have a half a mile from
wow.
the corner all the way down to where you can see the Indian grass stop and
right,
the
right.
corn takes over. So it's that 40 down there that has one of our ponds, and then there's another 40 to the north, and then another 40 up, including the farmstead, and that's where we'll go next.
Okay. Have you succeeded in collecting any seeds?
Oh, we Cindy engages in a large amount of seed collecting. So there's a great deal of hand collecting of seeds and stockpiling of seeds and then scattering of seeds, overseeding and reseeding and putting additional seed out in all of our restorations around here. This is part of the new property, and the land on our right was planted in 2011 and shows a huge crop of Indian grass. The land on our left was just planted a year ago, so you don't see any evidence of Indian grass at this time. There are instead a lot of plants that come on very early in prairie reconstruction, and we can see all sorts of things that will go away, like thistles and certain species of goldenrod. And surrounding the pond is a much younger planting.
Oh, I see it.
Where to put ponds is to look at soil maps.
Sure, of course.
And the various certain soil types arose because they were in these low wet spots, and so those are the appropriate places to break the tile and do a little bit of excavating to make it a little bit deeper and allow the pond to refill in a natural way. And this pond out here is sort of, in a sense, a reconstruction of what it might have been long ago before it was drained with tile lines. Although it may be a little deeper, but on the other hand, practice of farming takes all your soil from the uplands and puts it in the lowlands. So there is a great leveling that's been going on for quite a long time. And we're attempting here to sort of unlevel it a bit. This particular pond accumulated water very quickly because the tile lines that ran through it had become entirely clogged. So when we eventually removed those tile lines, we could see that they were no longer functioning. They were full of roots. But in addition to that, they've now actually been removed. You want to walk out?
No,
see it. This is barnyard grass. It's a non-native plant that likes to stand in, wet ground along with the bulrushes that are producing seeds now. And it has a nice purple panicle, and it's certainly coming on quite strong here all around the pond. This is some kind of sedge and or bulrush. You can feel the stem and find a triangular cross-section, and that's the mark of a stem. But we also have a lot of bulrushes occurring naturally out here. A lot of this farmland was not farmed as much as it might have been because Dennis tended to withdraw from the really wet parts. And we have a wet strip right down the middle that he had avoided, and it had become quite wide and was already a natural wetland in itself, based on the plants that normally occur in an agricultural setting. And what we've done, of course, is to reseed with additional native plants, and we're hoping that we'll create a wetland that has a lot of natives in it.
Did the cattails come in on their own?
Yes, the cattails came in on their own, and they may be a problem. They can become excessive, produce a monoculture, and crowd things out. So we're watching this and have noticed that the cattails have increased considerably on this pond. There is a species of non-native grass that was in a large patch at one end of the pond, and we wanted to get rid of that. That was Phragmites is the genus, and we had the soil dug up and moved elsewhere, so that stand has mostly been eliminated, but we do have some remnants over there, and we're hoping that they won't spread to the point of becoming a problem.
What is Phragmites? Is it the common name?
Yeah, Phragmites is the name of the genus, and it's the name that we use for the common. That's the name we use as the common name, and I don't actually know what the common name is. It's Phragmites something or anotherus. We have plenty of reed canary grass around, although you don't see much right in this particular area, but that's very reconstructions and restorations in Iowa.
This is a lovely place. It's amazing to think that this was intentionally recreated on a farm called Stargrass. It's a lovely place. How big is this pond you mentioned?
This is more than an acre in size. In fact, I think it's about 2 acres, maybe a little bit more than 2 acres, roughly circular. There's a stream flowing quite nearby, and we're hoping that wood ducks will nest out here, and but we have not yet seen wood ducks reproducing. On the other hand, this is a pretty wild area, and it's not easy to get to. So we expect that there's been geese and ducks reproducing up here that we're not aware of. So you can follow this tree line of largely dead trees until you get down to these isolated dead cottonwoods that are just these bare, white, bone-like structures sitting in the sky. And those are red-headed woodpecker habitat. We have had a pair of red-headed woodpeckers living up here almost every year since we've been here. And now we've gotten to the point where we see some red-headeds living south near the house. But these kinds of trees are exactly the sort of thing that you would want to leave up to provide habitat for woodpeckers.
So you have more than one pair of red-headed woodpeckers now, you think?
We do believe that we do have more than one pair. We think that there is one or possibly two pairs that have nested up here for years. Whether they're the same or not, we don't know. But we usually do see red-headeds up in this area on the farmstead. They have exactly what they need. There are stands of trees nearby and also large dead trees into which they can make a new cavity each year. And if you look at these wonderfully whited, skeleton-like dead cottonwoods over there, you can pick out several redhead woodpecker holes.
Do they migrate?
I'm not sure. I think that they do, yes. But Cindy is the real bird expert, so...
What are some other plants around the edge of this wonderful pond?
Well, right around the edge you can see a band of white, and we just walked through, you know, several dozen feet of nothing but shrubs with very tiny little white flowers. And these are all frost asters. They tend to bloom in the fall and acquire that name of frost aster. The yellow, there are some large yellow flowers. From this distance, I can't tell what they would be. There's cup plant, Jerusalem artichoke are examples, and sunflowers of various kinds are examples of plants that produce flowers like that. One of the plants that is included in our prairie plantings is stiff goldenrod. And stiff goldenrod will come on very strongly right after planting. And it spreads itself quite easily because the seeds are very light and fluffy and windborne. So seeing stiff goldenrod in a new prairie planting is a very nice thing, and you will see lots of them. But there are also other goldenrods that just survive in all sorts of agricultural settings. Yes, the easiest way is checking the feel for the leaf. Right. The stiff goldenrod has a nice rough texture to it. Do you get to know? There are several different species of goldenrod, and it's a little tricky to know which one you're looking at. I'm not so good at it, but I can certainly pick out the stiff goldenrod.
You mentioned recreating and recreating a prairie. Why do you do this?
It's fun, and it's fascinating, and it's very interesting, and I've always loved watching plants grow.
Oh, here, we're looking at...
Tick trefoil. Yeah. There is an Illinois tick trefoil and another one. This is Desmodium, that's the genus, and then which species it is, I don't remember. But this plant blooms huge numbers of little purple flowers. And for many years, we don't see them because the Japanese beetles come on strong and they eat all the flowers. And a couple of years ago, the Japanese beetles didn't show up. And one of our colleagues who does prairie restoration was seeing this wonderful plant all over his prairie, wondering what it is. And we thought, ah, we bet it's just Desmodium that has escaped the Japanese beetles this year. And so you're getting this huge floral display of all these lovely multicolored purple, blue little flowers. What's happened here is that the flowers and the plant are all balled up as a result of some sort of insect action. The leaves are all curled, the stems are all curled, so this is an interesting specimen in that it'll indicate some kind of insect action. They cause the plant to produce interesting configurations as part of their reproductive cycle.
It looks very clumpy.
It is. It's really it's like a fist of plant all squished up together. And this one is still blooming, which is a little bit unusual. I think most of them have gone by now.
Now we're standing in the 2014 or the 2011 planting.
This is the 2014 planting.
It's astonishing how few weeds there are.
Yes, well...
I mean, there are some, but...
There are plants here that I guess one could regard as weeds, and the prairie does regard them, I guess, as weeds, and they are thistles, for example.
Yeah.
These are nice native plants, native thistles, tall thistle, field thistle, that do not cause much problems, either for agriculture or prairie restoration, and they take the advantage of the disturbed soil and the fresh planting to come on strong, and then as the perennials start to take over, their populations go way down. In one of our fields, we saw a huge number of thistles the year after planting, and then the year after that, we didn't see any at all.
Wow, amazing.
So there are some weeds that need active management, some mechanical removal, but others you don't worry about, and they are just crowded out by the prairie plants.
So to the east, we see lots of Indian grass. Why is it the early grass? And I assume there are others that come on later.
The Indian grass that you're seeing there was planted in November of 2011. So it's had, I think four growing seasons.
Uh-huh.
And after three growing seasons, you really would expect to see a full complement of prairie plants. And in particular, your grasses will start to take over. And so this is a nice demonstration. If you gaze out over the pond, you can see all sorts of things that are not Indian grass. And then when you get beyond that, over where you can see Indian grass growing on the old planting, and you don't see it at all on this side. That's a nice, really dramatic demonstration of the difference in the two plantings. One is like 4 years old, and the other is really only a year old. So we expect that as the plantings mature and the differences in their ages go down, that we'll see a lot of Indian grass, say, for example, right where we're standing, and also in all of the area that it's not occupying.
What are your other grasses in the older planting?
We have all the standards. There's Indian grass and big blue stem and little blue stem and Sidotes grama. However, this area is a fairly low and wet area. So the grasses that prefer the drier sites, such as little blue stem and Sidotes grama, are not in as much evidence over here as big blue stem and Indian grass. At the moment, Indian grass is the one that's blooming or producing the most panicles, so it really dominates the view. And if you walked through there, you could find plenty of big bluestem, but it's not quite so obvious that that's what you're looking at.
From this distance, the Indian grass is a sea of red, purple, gold. It just has the color of fall, and it's tall and it's thick, and it moves like the ocean. Yes, it does. That's the prairie does move like the ocean.
Yes, it exhibits exactly the same kind of waves. We have a nice piece of land in which you can get a view from one hill of the opposite hill, and under really windy conditions, you can watch the waves crossing those hills exactly as if you were watching an ocean. I would suggest we walk back up and a large number of species gathered by hand, and is that reducing the technology seems to be a good thing to do. Throwing seed on the ground is apparently the best way. You can drill it if you want to, but if you want to imitate nature, throw it on the ground. And if you want to imitate nature, throw it on the ground in the fall so that it'll live there through the winter, and it'll get frozen and thawed and worked into the ground, and it'll be all ready in the spring, and the seeds will say, hey, yeah, I've been here all winter. I am ready to just germinate in this new territory occupied only by soybeans and corn. And so you tend to get a really big, tremendous flush of new plants, and many species will grow to enormous sizes because they have found themselves this wonderful opportunity with no competition. And as the plantings mature, other plants start to come in, things get crowded, and the populations of these early early bloomers, so to speak, can go down. Elemis virginicus, which is Canada wild rye, is an example of one of those grasses that comes on pretty strong, and you may see a lot of it in an early prairie planting, and then eventually you hardly see any of it. Indian grass is one that does the opposite. After a while, you begin to think, why did I plant so much Indian grass? Well, you didn't, but stuff gets around and it really takes over. The area around the pond was only planted a year ago. This pond, sitting upstream from the dam, is divided into two parts. The larger lower pond and a somewhat smaller upper pond, which is about 2 or 3 feet higher than the lower pond. And when the upper pond gets up to a certain level, the water flows around through a little channel, which you can almost see from here, and it goes down into the lower pond. Once it's in the lower pond, when it gets high enough, it flows out a drain right in the center of the dam. The guy who was doing the construction actually suggested making the upper pond, and this will increase the amount of wetlands that we have. And this upper pond turns out to be extremely popular with the ducks.
That's where all the ducks came from.
That's where they tend to hang out, and it's fairly small and really rather well protected. They have a large area down here, but they like this area upstream.
I think I saw 50 ducks come off there in the last 10 minutes.
That's what Cindy said she saw a couple of days ago. She was hoping when the class came out that there would be a few ducks, and they counted about 50. I think there are some sitting in the water right now, actually, off in the at the left end. We've seen several species, pintails of two types, wood ducks, lots of mallards.
There they go.
Here come some. It's a group of five coming into land. We've seen coots out here, geese. The very first time I came up to look at this pond after its construction, I saw in March something like 150 geese and 150 ducks and four trumpeter swans all sitting on there at once, and they all took off in this spectacular aerial display. And I haven't seen anything quite like that since then.
Watch them.
Ah, wow. There's 20-plus ducks coming in for a landing right now. Ooh, they've decided not to land. They're going to take off and circle around once more. Now they're heading back in there. Make another pass, and there they go. They're all settling down in the upper pond. And it would be nice to know what species they are, but we're not good on ducks yet. We'll have to learn more as we live with this pond.
And I wonder what percentage of north, central, northwest Iowa was wetland 200 years ago. Well, 10, 20%, I don't know, a lot of it.
A very great deal in the Ames area, because the Skunk River had these low, flat areas that were a tremendous wild bird production area. And the Skunk River got channelized, and so that whole area has been eliminated. But we still get the floods.
Right. But not the wildlife.
Yeah, that's true, yes. So this area right here is, well, it... I don't know, really, whether it's particularly unique and isolated, or, in fact, is part of a larger continuum of places. You know, from a bird's point of view, there are these little ponds here, but if you just go a mile over, you'll find the gravel pit.
Oh, right.
That's over on the other side of 30.
Right.
And, of course, then the Ada Hayden was gravel pit as well. So there are these bodies of water around that do attract birds on a temporary basis. What we're hoping is that this area, like many little spots around here, will become a favorite place for birds to breed.
Besides a huge expanse of prairie, wildlife habitat, including ponds, wetlands, everything is in different stages because it's been planted at different times. And it's really fun to see what thrives fast, what comes back year after year. It's amazing to talk to Roger Maddox about this. We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was a walk in the Stargrass Prairie with Roger Maddox. Very nice thing to do here in the fall. You are listening to KHOI 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa.
Welcome back. This is Donna Lana Kitchen. That was a tune called The Crested Hen. We have a little bit of news from the Donna Lana Kitchen news department here. In the past shows, we've been discussing the proposed Bakken pipeline. And we said we'd get back to you on when the hearings for this Bakken pipeline were going to happen. The process seems to be going on, and the Iowa Utility Board has set dates for the Bakken pipeline hearings. And in this area, the put this on your calendar. You may want to maybe interested in this. The dates have been set Thursday, November 12th. For a public comment session, and Monday, November 16th, for an evidentiary hearing. Both events will take place at 9 a.m. at the Boone County Fairgrounds Community Building. So that's in November. Yes, the Bakken Pipeline issue rolls on. Let's get to something a bit sweeter here. Donna, what's on your plate?
Oh, Lana brought me a gift today. I have had a marvelous garden of shiso. It seems it loves the rain. So shiso is this Japanese, it's mostly known in Japan. Like, you will get a leaf of it with something or other at the end of a meal. I think it must be a digestive or something, but it has a very distinct flavor, which I like a lot. And I grew three kinds this summer, a Korean variety, which I have not figured out what to do, but they're very pretty. And then the sort of classic green one, and then the red shiso is also known as perilla and is used in Italian cooking. We have talked about this before on the show, but I had so much, and I still do. I'm going to try to dry it. I'm going to try to – I think I'll make a vodka infusion, as a matter of fact. But Lana has made me a jelly, and it is – subtle but very delightful. Thank you, Lana. How was the process?
You're welcome. You mentioned that the volatile oils in it are very volatile. So boiling, which unfortunately is how I make jelly. Of course, you have to boil it, and it tends to release all the smell, all the taste, and it tends to go up in the air. So I worked really, really fast. I hope the jelly's got a little bit of taste. So I make it like I make any kind of herb jelly. I use an apple base, and I use some Northern Spy apple juice because I had a lot of windfalls just right. And Northern Spy at this stage it's tasty, but it's not too overly tart this time of year. And so I had this nice apple base, and I infused the shiso in the apple.
Shiso.
Yes, I did. And made kind of a really strong tea out of it, and then continued on adding the pectin and sugar. And it set up just fine. And also I put some chopped up herb bits in it too, so it's kind of floating around in there just for some interest. So there it is. Yes, you can make jelly.
I think I might try it like on a savory sandwich, even with maybe some sliced chicken and a little bit of maybe sautéed onion or something, and then the shiso, using it almost in a chutney-like kind of way.
I think it'd be good that way. It doesn't have a fruity sort of taste.
No, I think it'll be good on toast as well.
Yeah, more of an aromatic thing.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you for the shiso jelly.
Well, good. Thank you. It's kind of funny-looking stuff there, swimming around in there, because of all of the green leaves mixed with the pinkish sort of apple juice. The jelly is kind of a clear golden brownish stuff, but
it's very pretty.
It is pretty.
It is very pretty.
Yeah.
And this was just the green shiso, or did you use some of the red?
The big bunch that you gave me, and you had like two little chunks of red in there.
I put a little red in.
Yeah.
Right.
So
okay.
Yeah.
All right. I am set for my shiso supply for the winter. Thank you very much, Lana Noctigal.
Most welcome, Donna Priskintas. We have some upcoming things happening. There's so much going on.
Oh, busy, busy weekend.
Well, this past week, Ames had its very own Oktoberfest. Only Ames would have an Oktoberfest in September, but I'm sure much good food
can't,
and beer
can't
was
get enough
off.
Of that beer drinking.
Oh,
here.
Oh, that, it's good. And pocus. Don't forget the pocus. The pocus. Okay. Speaking of apples and the nice apple book we talked about earlier, there is this coming Saturday, The 26th, from 9 o'clock in the morning to noon, there is a cider pressing at Mustard Seed Farm. And for more information, go to mustardseedfarm.com.
It'll be gorgeous out there. And they have an original, old-fashioned, hand-cranked wooden cider press.
So bring apples, and I'm sure everybody has some apples someplace or other. You know somebody with an apple tree. And be sure, if you bring apples, bring your own containers to bring that stuff home in, because when you start smooshing those apples down, you end up with lots of cider, lots of cider. The Ames Farmers Market and lots of area farmers markets are still going strong. Get out there and visit your local farmer. Talk to him. Get good stuff to eat.
How long does our farmer's market go?
Well, there is a farmer's market on Main Street, and that goes through October from those hardy souls who will still be there. And a note, October time starts at 9 o'clock as opposed to 8 o'clock. Thank you to the organizers for changing that. So October hours will be a little shorter, starting at 9 o'clock in the morning. And here we have another thing coming up. It is the second annual chili cook-off for the Ames Main Street Farmers Market. I have here in my very hand. That happens here this coming Saturday. And I have here in my very hand the official rules and regulations for the chili cook-off for the Ames Main Street Farmers Market. It's a second annual. Last year was really a dandy bunch of chili. There's free samples. There's information on this. And to find more information on this, contact the Ames Street Farmers Market. You can just Google Ames Street Farmers Market and get an entry form. Yes. And there's a local foods potluck coming up Saturday, Brookside Park, 4 to 7, sponsored by Wheatsfield Grocery.
Oh, this is a fun event.
Maple Shelter, Brookside Park. Local foods potluck from 4 to 7, September 26th.
So make your own local foods dish.
Everybody has such a good time.
And then Wheatsfield provides
a local
beverage, beer, wine.
Yes, and soft drinks. And they provide a main dish. I don't know what it is going to be this year, but in the past they've grilled up stuff. They've made tacos and they've made all. I don't know what it's going to be this year. It'll be really good. So, local foods potluck, 4 to 7, September 26th at Brookside Park. And the Octagon Art Festival is this Sunday on Main Street. KHOI will have a booth. Don is off to the Prairie Festival in Kansas this weekend, and she'll have a report next week.
Mm-hmm.
Good. And more things to do. The Central Iowa Barn Dance is this Saturday. If you went to the Clogger Barn Dance last week in Nevada, you can do some more dancing this weekend, September 26th. Go to Central Iowa Barn Dance, CIBD.org.
So you could go to the local foods potluck and then show up for the barn dance and then the next day hit the Octagon Arts Festival.
Enjoy this
Woo-hoo!
Good weather. Yes, yes. More things to do. Contra dance. Yes, yes. We've been listening to the music of a contra dance band called Wild Asparagus from their CD Live at the Guiding Star Grange. We heard Roger Maddox talk about his prairie, the Stargrass Prairie. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We'd love to hear from you. What's on your plate? Contact us, khoiradio@gmail.com. We've had excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. Eat good food. Enjoy life.